Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
We're grateful to have you all here. No matter how many times I have the opportunity to interact with folks around the topics that we'll be thinking about today and go through the week, I'm always glad to do it again. And glad that there are many people seem to be interested in the issues of simpler living, compassionate living, global economics and the connection between our own lives and justice and faith. It seems to me that those issues and how we create our culture in the future and our economies may determine whether how long we survive as a species and how long lots of other species survive. And issues of creation and decreation, as Bill Gibbon calls it, decreation, are matters of great theological importance if we believe in a creator and that the creator gave us a good creation and made us an intricate part of that as well. Why don't we have a moment of silence to gather ourselves here, and I'll say a brief prayer. The Lord be with you. God, we're always grateful to be at Holden for the beauty all around us, for this warm day, for the friends and family around us, and for how this place speaks of you as well. We ask for you to be with us. In your name, amen. Amen. It's particularly exciting for me today. My mom and dad and girlfriend and sisters and nephew and very close friends are all here today. So they're all kind of over in this end of the room. And Janine, one of my closest friends in the world, who I've known for 19 years, is with the one with the baby. She'll be teaching later, and it's going to be very interesting stuff. And then also Dale sitting back. Want to raise your hand, Dale? Dale will be speaking later this whole week, too. And a couple years ago, we were on staff together teaching, and one of the sessions particularly that I went to of his, I've sort of relentlessly plagiarized his stuff since then. Always crediting him, as before. I thought I would introduce myself briefly so you know a little bit where I'm coming from, and then introduce Earth Ministry a little bit, and then move on to kind of the content for today. Although this introduction is really part of the content, because I hope it relates in some way. Or I think Frederick Buechner talks about all of our lives as being a sacred journey. And in the beginning of his book, called The Sacred Journey, which is the beginning of three books, a trilogy on his own life, he says, what I want to do now is to listen to my whole life for whatever of meaning of God, of holiness, there is in it to hear. My contention is, he says, that the story of any one of us is in some measure the story of us all. So that when we speak of our own lives deeply and of our own stories, that it might encourage you also to listen to your own life. And I hope that this week you do feel invited to listen to your own story and how you might feel called to respond to the kinds of things we'll be talking about. So I went to, I'm not going to tell a lot about myself, but just a little bit. I went to Wheaton College in Illinois, which is a pretty conservative evangelical school, as many of you probably know. And then after I went to Wheaton, I went to Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. Have any of you heard of Church of the Savior in D.C.? Just one or two? Okay. It's a really interesting model of being a church. And I worked with homeless men for a year. I lived with homeless men for a year. And then I worked in the environmental field for some years, but was still part of the church community. And in both Wheaton College, which is quite conservative, evangelical, and Church of the Savior, in both those rather different settings, a fairly liberal, progressive place, and a fairly conservative, evangelical one, did I hear a prayer or a sermon about care for creation that I can recall? Or even that, in a sense, we're part of creation. creation essentially was the backdrop on which the human drama took place, the stage on which the human drama took place. And when I talk with folks around this area and around the country about this, most people say, yeah, that's the worldview I got in my church. Very human-centered, separating God from nature, separating us from nature. And so I imagine if you folks grew up in the church, or even the church's worldview, the Christian worldview in that time has also affected our culture as a whole. So even if you didn't grow up in the church, you probably have that kind of, you know, tendency to view the world in that way. And when I went to, after Wheaton, I went to the University of Oregon and did a master's in environmental studies. And I think I was, all right, yeah. Ooh, back. Good. Yeah. Anyone else here? All right. We'll talk later. Okay. Did a master's in environmental studies in Eugene. And one of the first articles I read was by Lynn White, a 67 science article, Historic Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis, in which Lynn White said, he's a historian, said, well, basically, Christianity is to blame for the worldview that did all those things. Separates us from nature, separates God from nature, and was incredibly anthropocentric or human-centered. And so, well, yeah, there's quite a bit of truth to that, I thought, in how it's developed in the West, right? But not inherently true, it seemed to me, to my own experience, necessarily, to my experience in the outdoors, to certain strands of Christianity, Celtic Christianity is often one people point to, or to certain, to the scriptures. So I began to explore that, maybe out of defense, partly because I was like probably the only Christian in this program, and I wanted to be able to, I mean, there was a lot of antagonism toward the Christian worldview, not necessarily toward me, but toward the worldview that I thought had a lot to offer. So I began to explore that and created a curriculum to teach environmental justice, theology, and sustainability within churches. And I taught a couple of churches in Eugene, actually, and I taught that curriculum twice there. And that is what eventually I sent that to Earth Ministry and began working at Earth Ministry 7 years ago. So Earth Ministry, some of you probably picked up a flyer. If you want to get some later, you can. It tells us a little bit about what we do, and then also there's a handout here with some pictures on it and a summary of our publications. But our mission is to help connect individuals and congregations, connect the Christian faith to care for creation and justice for all creation. So both working at sort of the worldview and theology level, do a lot of presentations and speaking and teaching around that. But also, so what would that mean in everyday life? So we've engaged church groups in restoration projects. On salmon-bearing rivers, for example, in the Seattle area. Take field trips to places and teach about what's going on there. And always provide a context, so why are we called to this as people of faith? And how are environmental justice issues connected to social justice issues? How is caring for people also part, or how is caring for the earth also connected to caring for people, and so on? One of the, just a little bit more about Earth Ministry if you want to later, we have, this is an incredible piece of work by my colleague, one of our program associates. It's called A Greening Congregation's Handbook. And it's chock full of resources for greening your congregation, but also there's a process that can help guide a group, a small group in a church, in an annual plan and an implementation of a plan to green your church. And it's a very holistic view of greening in the sense that it looks at worship, you know, what's the message being given from the pulpit or in the songs or in the prayers in your own church, your educational process, the kinds of courses being taught, and also how you heat and light your building and how you take care of the land around it and all these, you know, the kinds of food you serve at your potlucks and so on. So the Greening Congregations Handbook, and then our Earth Letter, which is a mini journal, Christian Environmental Spirituality in Action. Feel free to pick copies of that up. And around the room, there are a few copies of Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, which is one of the texts I'll be working from this week. Unfortunately, the bookstore has sold out of these. There's supposed to be like 20 copies up there, but there aren't any right now. So I have six with me. So if you want to get one from me, You can do that 1627 Earth Ministries, just so you don't, you can leave a check or something behind. If I'm busy talking to people, then you can grab a copy if you want. If we run out, the bookstore should have more by Wednesday or Thursday. So. Any questions about Earth Ministry or? We also have a mailing list over there if you want to get on our mailing list, and we'll send you a packet of information about us and an invitation to join us if you would like to. So let's take out that half sheet. I was leading a weekend retreat, I don't know, a year and a half ago, and when I was sort of, I had gone through a couple sessions with people, I thought it would be helpful to summarize what we were trying to do together, I guess. And I thought it would be a helpful way to introduce what I think we'll be trying to do together this week. And so first, it's a summary, the broadest overview of our time together. First, our ways of living and thinking place an incredible burden on our planet and place a large burden on our own lives. Second, changing our ways of living and thinking requires some kind of ongoing, heartfelt conversion, not motivated by guilt, but rather an invitation to greater freedom and joy. Third, God's character in Christ's life calls to compassion, felt as empathy and embodied as justice for all creation, and teach us that all of life, including our own, is sacred. We are free to fall in love with all that is sacred. When we do so, our ways of living and thinking and our economies can change to reflect that sanctity. These changes will not be easy, as we all benefit from the current setup and economy, and they may require us to open ourselves to both personal and ecological grief, which is never something we necessarily want to do, or often. These changes will be exciting, challenging, invigorating, and are possible. They quite possibly are necessary if we are to pass on to our grandchildren the kind of world we would hope for them to enjoy. So there's a lot behind each of those, and we'll kind of unpack those as we go this week, and some today. And what I want to start with is to ask you about number two. Number one. Good place to start. I hadn't looked at my notes to tell me to start with number one. Because then we're going to do number two next. So I guess my question is about number one. For some of you to share, when you do, please say your name and where you're from. How do our ways of living and thinking either place a burden, heavy burden on our planet or on your own lives? How would you answer that question personally? And maybe you don't agree with that statement, but so go ahead, raise your name and where you're from.
I'm Sarah Strang from Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
And I always say that you cannot explain to anybody what life in Dallas is. You have to live there to experience it, because it is a plastic society.
For you, is that experience both as a burden on the planet and on your own life?
It can be, and I fight very much to keep the latter from happening. But I'm caught up in it. That's where I live.
Will you explain plastic?
Plastic means that you don't go any place without your credit card.
Oh.
They don't accept checks, but they'll take credit cards.
And how does it affect you personally, that way of the way of living there?
Well, it's totally different from being here at Holden.
Yeah.
Artificial.
So it feels artificial and.
Well, and it's a way of life that you can't explain till you've experienced it. It's different from Fort Worth, which is very close by. And before I moved to Dallas, I could never understand how JF Kennedy could have been shot in Dallas. But after I moved to Dallas, I began to understand the mentality and how that could happen.
Thanks. How about people from other parts of the country? Maybe there are other plastic societies here. Someone else had a hand up over here, I thought. Yeah.
Well,
your name?
Ranch. Yeah,
Mazzella.
I live on a ranch in eastern Nebraska, and I've seen our little column of 1,000 people just deteriorate because Walmart moved in 20 miles away, and they have all this junk that people just buy. And they've driven out the smaller businesses in our area, like the hardware stores and even the local grocery stores suffer because they now carry groceries.
Yeah, so some small town breakdown is going on because of...
And their plastic bags are all over the area. They just blow out the windows. And they do recycle them, but you have to take them back, and people cannot do that.
Anyone else?
Well, as part of that, you know, it's we love the C word, convenience.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, if we can get everything at a Walmart as opposed to having to face you and you and you and all different stores, it's just much easier to do it at one, and we are not aware of the cost, or we ignore the cost. Unless you consciously say, I'm going to help my neighbor John and his small business at the local grocery store as opposed to Spaceway or Winco or something like that. Hidden cost of being stupid.
Okay. Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh. My name is Pat Hudson. I'm from Green Bay, Wisconsin. It is known as the Fox Valley and paper mill country. It's a rich area. Rich area. We very seldom have a lot of unemployment and so on. But all these papers are located on the Fox River, which extends from Lake Winnebago north to Lake Green Bay and Lake Michigan. And through the years, they have polluted this terribly bad. And every time the pressure is put on them to clean it up, they say, well, that'll mean job layoffs, and then they back off. They've given them 12 years to start cleaning it up, and they haven't done that. So the EPA is threatening to go ahead with it. But it's really discouraging to live in that community and see this beautiful water is so terribly polluted, you wouldn't walk in.
Thank you.
Paul Martinson from Hudson, Wisconsin. And we've lived a lot in rural America, and life is very different there than in Dallas, where there, it isn't that we don't deal with problems like pollution and insecticides and herbicides, but there in my life, there's always been a struggle with how to use God's creation in farming.
Mm-hmm.
Not all farmers think this way, but quite a few of the churches have celebration of Rogation Sunday.
Yeah.
We have handed out hundreds of trees. You know, so apparently a lot of depends upon where you live and your circumstances as to how you view the creation. Farmers are very, very close to God's creation.
What's the economy like for farmers in your area?
Well, this year the prospects are very good. The crops are beautiful. But I've stood with farmers that have had to sell their farms. We had four veterinarians in our congregation. We now have two, and they'll probably become one. So, you know, you get all those dynamics. It's very complex. So, larger farms and communities that are going down the pike because they don't have sustainable businesses. But if you serve in rural America, you're very conscious of the earth, the land, how it's used, irrigation, putting swamps back into tillable soil and taking tillable soil and leaving it fallow, and just go on.
Yeah. Well, I put up their hidden cost of farming, and yet also a sense of the need and an ethic of care as yeah. well in your area. Well, I think let's move on here. But did you have
something? I just wanted to say, I think my name is Kathy Hume. I'm from Salem, Oregon. One of the biggest drains on all of us is our love affair with the automobile. Our love affair with the automobile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a heart, not a palate. yeah, good. Well, it's good to hear that. I think if we raise these kind of questions in any group, we would probably get some of these kinds of things being raised. I think there's a shared sense in our culture that some things are pretty off. But we're not, I don't think we're sure why or where it is we need to go. It seems like kind of a liminal time. Just I want to throw a few others up there that always strike me. We are losing species at 1,000 times the background rate. You know, species are always going extinct. We're currently in the midst of the sixth great extinction event. The last great one was during the dinosaurs. And the reasons for this extinction are all human caused. Habitat destruction is the primary one. If you think about the diversity and beauty of life on Earth, and that our habits are causing those beautiful creatures and places to be extinct in some cases, it's rather sobering. Global warming would be another heavy burden on the planet and heavy burden on people's lives. The island nations that will be most affected by the rise in sea level are usually rather poor countries. Bangladesh will largely be underwater, especially the place of the Bay of Bengal, so where many people live. So there are ways to connect our love of the automobile, let's say, with justice, with people's need to have a place to be, and so on. And we'll talk more about farming later this week, too, I imagine. Another book will be coming out in about 2 months called Food and Faith, Justice, Joy, and Daily Bread. Same publisher that did this one. And a lot of the issues around farming and faith will be raised there. But let's shift to a more hopeful tack here, and that is to go to number two. And for this, I'm grateful to Dale. Here's where I want to tell the story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. But and to do so with Dale's interpretation of that in mind. And Dale, you'll be talking about this week as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Well, you'll get a quick preview from me, because I think it's so helpful for thinking about these problems, for thinking about simplicity. And then I think I'm really excited to get to hear Dale present it again as well. But you probably all know the story, right? Jesus is going into the wilderness for 40 days. And after those 40 days, the tempter, or Satan, comes to Jesus. And there are three temptations. But before that, I want to set it up a little bit. Dale talked about how we often reduce sin in our lives and in our churches and so on. Sin is reduced to acts, A-C-T-S, to certain acts. And if you do or don't do these things, that's sort of the barometer by which you check your own spirituality. And so if you're, Yeah, you know, I haven't killed anyone lately or committed adultery or lied to my parents and so on and so on. Well, maybe I'm doing okay. You know, I'm doing pretty well here. We don't have a sense of being enslaved to sin when Paul talks about being enslaved to sin. And why is it we don't have a sense of that being enslaved to sin? Enslaved sounds like something rather deep from which we would need to be freed rather than a list of do's and don'ts and whether or not we succeed in following those. So when we have Eucharist, and last night we had Eucharist, you know, I remember Dale asked the question, why don't we leave church jumping and skipping and shouting? If we had a sense of being enslaved and then being free, you know, how delightful that would be. And indeed, why don't we leave church skipping and jumping? Woo! You know, I'm free. I'm out of here. I've been freed again to live fully, to live who I really am to be. So to get at that, Dale reflected on the temptation in the wilderness. And it's been something that's been very important for me. Indeed, I left that session feeling more free. And it's been something I often go back to. So the tempter goes to Jesus, and what's the first word that the tempter says? Small word?
If.
And what does the if do? It raises questions about who you are, your self-identity, right? So if you're the Son of God, so Jesus is like, am I really the Son of God, you know? Or if you're Mike Scott, if you're Wayne Scott, if you're Janine Diller Murphy, then do these things, right? So if you're the Son of God, the first one is turn these stones into bread. So that is the temptation to prove who you are by your abilities. Pretty impressive. Take a stone and turn it into bread. If you're the Son of God, or if you're whoever, prove who you are by your abilities. That's the first temptation. Second one is where he goes up to the top of the temple and says, you know, throw yourself down because God said, you know, I won't let your foot strike a stone and you'll be saved by the angels. And wouldn't that be cool? And Jesus declines. The temptation there is to prove who you are by the reactions and responses you get from other people. Because just think of it. Jesus is, in a sense, forcing God's hand. God's like, oh no, there goes my son. If you're the Son of God, there goes my son. I better save him. Forcing God to do something, thereby proving that you're pretty special. So you prove who you are by the reactions and responses you get from other people. And the third one, Jesus is brought up to the top of a mountain and sees all the kingdoms of the world, right? And the devil says, if you bow down to me, I will make you king of all these, all that you see. And that one is like, immediately connects to what I'll always do, but to consumerism. Prove who you are by your status, by your power and your positions of power and your possessions. Because if you're the king of the world, you're going to have plenty of both, plenty of power and plenty of possessions. Prove who you are by your positions of power and your possessions. Or you'll know you're somebody by all these things. And all three of these are what? They're simply efforts at self-justification. You're needing to prove who you are, rather than the thought we seem to have, the belief we seem to have, that we're saved by the grace of God, that you're justified through grace. And that's enough, right? Is what we hope to believe, want to believe, what we hear. And yet, there are these temptations to always need to prove who we are, to self-justify. And so, Dale was suggesting that the essence of being enslaved to sin are these efforts at self-justification. We become anxious people and afraid we're not enough. And what needs to die? And Dale will be talking about what does it mean to die in order to live. What must die is the self that we create through these efforts of self-justification. for the self that God created to blossom and be born and live freely. So, one, prove who you are by your abilities. Two, prove who you are by the reactions and responses you get from other people. And three, prove who you are by your possessions and positions of power. Just as an example for myself, that I thought, you know, one way that would really relate to me could be that I would be very vested in how you all, or whatever I speak or something, how you all respond to me. So number two, prove who I am by the reactions and responses I get from all of you today. You can see how that could be rather enslaving pretty quickly. Because if I don't get what I need from you folks, I've got to go prove it again really quickly somewhere else, or, you know, come up and talk to you about, well, what to think, you know, how to go. And it would be this sort of effort, needlessly striving, ongoing effort to prove who I am by how you respond to me. As opposed to it, doing it from a place of freedom seems to me would be doing it from a place of call, that I feel called to this work, that if I have any gifts in this way, they are not my own. They are from God, ultimately. And that I would just like to offer them and hope that they might be of help to others. So it's a place of freedom. And if I'm called to something else, then that's fine. But that has been very freeing for me. Just one example of how seeing my efforts of self-justification as enslaving has made a lot of sense. And I wonder if for you, you know, proving who you are by your abilities, proving who you are by the reactions and responses you get from others, or proving who you are by your possessions and positions of power have been enslaving for you. And indeed, you can. I think it's not hard to, and one of the today's sessions is the spirituality of simplicity, because I think it's crucial that when we talk about simplicity, or, let me back up a minute. Evangelical Christianity quickly becomes a list of do's and don'ts. For me it did, and it became life draining, spirit draining. Environmentalism, I sometimes wonder if that's one of the reasons I was drawn to environmental work, is that that can become a list of do's and don'ts, can't it? I mean, we could all list the things we're supposed to and not supposed to do environmentally, what's better and what's not better by now. Thankfully, at least we know what some of those are now, but now we get guilty about it. And simplicity can become a list of do's and don'ts. So it's crucial that we start any discussions that might end up challenging ways we live, and sometimes visible ways, that we come from a place of freedom and a spirituality of simplicity that sets us free from these temptations. Is one powerful way to look at it, I think. And that's why I start with that in going into talking about voluntary simplicity, global economics, and justice, and so on, so that we're starting from a place of freedom, of connection with God, and our own personal story and how it intersects with what we're hearing. Comments on that? I guess I like to call it a brief meditation, really, on Jesus' temptations in the wilderness, and before we move on. I saw a hand there, yeah.
Evelyn Strang, Sabine, Texas. The point of connection with God. I would really like to start with number four, that celebrating what is in the creation. When you really look at scriptures, God saw it was good. There are all kinds of admonition. When you fall in love with nature and what's out there without worshiping it, that is a start. I mean, people in Dallas and the Plastic Society could care less about what happens to salamanders if they're about to go belly up. I mean, because we are so separated from mm-hmm. nature. Even Texas, 80% of the people are in the cities. We have three of the largest cities in the country. so that the separation from nature, we see no reason to care. Now, if you live in beautiful Washington State, you're a lot closer to some of this, and you do care. But until it directly affects your life, I mean, the people driving on the freeways in our cities aren't caring about the environment.
So that's me. I drive on the freeway in the cities, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way we have to get around. But, I mean, you know, that is their life pretty much in there. And so I want to start with caring for God's creation,
mm-hmm.
not having dominion, because we've interpreted that verse many times to know it really means to tenderly care for the earth. But if you are in love with God's creation as an expression of God and as something that really calls you to worship the Creator, then you begin to be moved also to show compassion to God's creatures,
yeah.
and God's your fellow human beings, and to care for this creation. Because if you start with how bad this is, you know, to do something, first you need to care to convert people.
Amen. And we certainly... Wednesday we're going to do a meditative hike that will hopefully be, for some anyway, an experience of that. With silence, with prayers and poems, with a brief reading, that would... I agree. I mean, you can... One of the things I love to do that I haven't done for some years is lead backpacking trips. And that experience... That being out there for 10 days, you don't have to say a word. You don't really hardly have to say a word, and people start getting it. But I still think you can, let's say we do start there, and we are indeed falling in love with all that is.
The challenge is, how do you do that in the city? Yeah,
yeah, that's exactly. Well, and there's certainly ways, there's still images of God in the city, and some of which are natural, and some of which, you know, there are a lot of people around which we say are images of God as well. But I think there's still a need to begin, okay, what's our motivation? Is it love and freedom, or is it duty and obligation? And so I have found this meditation on the temptations in the wilderness particularly freeing, and I hope it can be for you as well. Any other testimonials?
Those of us who are here, Tom Von Fisher, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Those of us who were here for Bible study last week, a couple quotes are still up that are really key for us. And Brueggemann, a New Testament theologian, works with the wilderness stuff, and he talks about how the perceived scarcity, sometimes the call to simplicity is a sense of perceived scarcity. I've been living an abundant life, and I can't do that anymore for justice reasons or whatever. Whatever your motivation leads you to a sense of perceived scarcity, misses the sense of abundance that is still there. So, you know, the quote says that the gift of bread transforms the wilderness. You know, so from that point on, Israel would entertain the thought that this place out in the wilderness, where there's nothing other than manna every day, in fact became life-giving to them. And there was wonderful abundance, not in stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Erlander's, you know, talks about where there's a wilderness, there's a school. So when we come to wilderness, it's a bit of a school for all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were here with our family when they were young for 10 weeks, and really thought we kind of solidified some of these issues, and our two kids are just living an incredibly materialistic life. And, you know, it's a sense of this ongoing dialogue for us with our kids who are married and just need to have all this stuff. You know, that what is scarcity in your life? What's simplicity and what's abundance? And, you know, a lot of those seeds were planted here at Olden when they were little kids. Mm-hmm. And we trust in one way or another we'll come back around. But there's a lot of grieving for all of us in this whole issue of simplicity and the justice of issues raised.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want, with that backdrop, I think this kind of the freedom is to see the abundance in ways other than stuff. Or what Erlander calls a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
Becoming a big deal with all our stuff.
Thank you.
And so I would like to see a little bit of what simplicity is, join the garbologist some morning. It's always made me wonder, since the World War II days, when we recycled everything, and that was a mentality, why that mentality somehow didn't hang on as soon as things got to be more available, by away we went, like Tom says, to be an overblown consumer society, and we throw everything away. It's kind of sad that what doesn't happen here.
I'm really proud of that, because that was my uncle Russell Wool was the one who designed and created the idea for this composting.
All right.
From a Minnesota farm.
Oh, yeah. Well, my dad grew up on a Minnesota farm. My mom on an Iowa farm. So I have some pride in that background as well. But this is a perfect way to segue in a way to, very rich discussions can happen around simplicity. I mean, we're hearing these various things right now. But there's also a danger in, again, making an idol out of simplicity itself. We can become sort of proud of our simplicity, and then it's like, I'm a simpler than thou. Or at Earth Ministry, we talk about having a simpleton award every year. You know, it's just like, oh, forget it. And an effort to keep down with the Joneses, you know, as opposed to.
For example, ride a bicycle to church. My situation was, I never learned to ride a bike, and at my age, I've tried it, and I don't have a good sense of balance. So, yeah. You can be judgmental of somebody who's still driving while other people might use the bike. And that's just an illustration.
And
it doesn't
so,
fit everybody.
No, and again, so that's one of the reasons I start from this. Dale, go ahead.
Well, just, I live in too big a house. I drive. We have two cars, much too big. I eat a lot more food than I need. I spend on enjoyments far more than I need. And so what I hear you say, and maybe it's kind of a mutual admiration society right now, but that to just simplify in little ways is not what it's about in terms of what Jesus calls us to. To really question this whole way of life takes a level of spiritual transformation. I need to discover a whole way of knowing and experiencing the world, and to be set free to that. Jesus is radical.
Yeah.
And so if we look at just, you know, a couple little things that we can do to help preserve that are valuable, but also I think we are so stuck in these ruts and so assume them that it takes quite a transformation to be free.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons, for example, the book is called Simpler Living, not Simple Living. Simpler Living connotes a journey. It connotes learning and growing. Simple Living connotes I've made it now. You know, there it is, simple living. And then the second part of the title is Compassionate Life. The Dalai Lama says, compassion seems to me to be the greatest power. But we tend to have a watered-down view of compassion, in that it's a nice feeling for someone, or it's felt as empathy. But Frederick Buechner, one of my favorite authors, says, compassion seems to be that fatal capacity for knowing what it's like to live inside another's skin. So there's the felt as empathy, knowing what it's like to live inside another's skin. Then he goes on, knowing there can never really be peace and joy for any until there is peace and joy finally for all. Knowing there can never really be peace and joy for any until there is peace and joy finally for all. And that seems to me to be hinting at, maybe variety we could call it, but it seems to me that's embodying compassion. Embodied love, embodied justice would be knowing there could never really be peace and joy for any until there's peace and joy finally for all. And that's a difficult thing. I mean, certainly we all experience peace and joy in our lives at different times, and we're also aware that there's not peace and joy everywhere for others. But a deeply lived compassion, I think, would call us to ever deeper levels of acting and loving on behalf of those who do not. So compassion becomes felt as empathy and embodied as justice. And that's really the perspective that the book is coming from. It's also, you know, in 1994, a little bit more about how simplicity is perceived in our culture. In 1994, the Trends Research Institute identified it as one of the top 10 trends in America. And yet, if you would look at certain barometers of simplicity, so to speak, or of compassionate living, I don't think those have gone up since 1994. And you see magazines called Real Simple, where they sell beds for $4,000 with simple lines. You know, a nicely knit wool sweater for little boys and girls that cost $300. So I think what they're tapping into, though, is a desire to live a life reflective of core values somehow. And I think they've also tapped into beauty as one of the core values of simplicity, and one that I really celebrate, and one that relates in some ways to number four, this beauty of all creation, this falling in love with beauty. But it, in a sense, it defines the good life. I think over here you guys are talking about good life, abundant life. It defines the abundant life as simply defined by possessions, and perhaps possessions of things of beauty, whereas it seems that's more a definition of the good life that our culture has. The good life is something we see on billboards all around us. It's advertised every time we turn on the TV. And the abundant life is something that Christ calls us to and offers, apparently. I've come that you might have life and life abundantly. And I think it's quite easy to mix those two, to say once you have the good life as defined by American culture, to define that as abundance. When in fact, and maybe it's difficult because the good life does mimic some abundance, some things of abundance, doesn't it? The good life says, okay, you can take care of your family. You have enough material possessions to take care of your family, maybe a few other people. But it defines the community you're called to care for is quite small, whereas the abundant life would define the community you're called to care for as much broader. Indeed, the community of all creation. And that abundance exists in the health and well-being of the total community, not just your own family, let's say. So those are some of the kinds of things that Simple Living Compassionate Life tries to help people get into and talk about. There's a study guide at the back, too, that I wanted to point out briefly. That small groups go through in churches. And it's meant to be very easy to use. The role of facilitator, for example, rotates. So that if you called the group together, you wouldn't need to lead each session. But at the end of session one, you decide who wants to lead next week. And there are 6, 8, 12-week sessions, options you could do. Some groups, I've heard a lot of groups say, oh, we started doing the 6-week one, but we wanted to do all 12 once we got going. One group in Wenatchee spent 31 weeks going through the book because they wanted to spend 1 week on each essay. So it's meant to be very flexible and community building, because if we're to go into these issues at any depth, things will be challenging to us, and they'll challenge certain parts of our worldview, certain parts of our habits, and hopefully be help on the road to transformation. Hopefully there's a spirituality that's called or based in the book and out of it that will help call people to transformation. Because while simple living is not primarily what's of do's and don'ts in this culture, it does need to eventually affect how we live, because 4% of this world lives in America and we contribute 25% of the global warming gases to the atmosphere. And we could go on and on about our impacts, but that gets old, and that's why I don't tend to start from, like Dale was saying, what are the small steps we could take, but to start from the reality of our enslavement and what is it we need to be freed from in order to live in a new way. So, are there any comments, further comments on anything?
How about redistribution of wealth? We looked at Denmark, and the Danes try, there's a very clever saying of a Danish theologian, and I don't remember it exactly, but he was saying in the one sentence, we Danes are trying to reduce the wealthy and bring up the poor, so that there's a society here that
very few rich, but even fewer poor.
That's it. And I think through their taxation system, they do that.
Right, and that brings up, often simplicity gets reduced to sort of individual acts.
Yeah.
You know, what I consume, what I do, what I don't do. But there's a whole section in the book, and indeed it brings up the politics of simplicity. Is there, because we can certainly want to live out of certain values. Let's say we want to try and bike or bus more. But if it takes us an hour to get across town on the bus, and we can get there in 10 minutes in our car, it's real hard to make that shift.
Yeah.
Similarly, our culture, America, has a tax structure and a corporate structure that creates a lot of wealth for very few,
yeah.
and creates a wider and wider gap between rich and poor. So it points to there needing to be a politics of simplicity that would make the culture, it would be easier in a sense to embody simplicity within a culture that had certain taxes versus others. Another example would be, and Alan Gurney has written about this in a book called Tax Shift, if green taxes essentially say, well, let's tax things we don't want. We don't want the natural world to be destroyed. Let's tax resource extraction. Let's not tax work. We want people to work. Let's not have income taxes. So shifting a tax structure, shifting transportation policy, shifting zoning laws would enable us to live in different ways and begin to embody a more sustainable, simple way of living over time. So your comment is very timely in the sense of moving from what we were primarily talking about seemed to be an individual choices to moving toward a politics of simplicity,
yeah.
Which is crucial as well.
We have this marvelous MD, I think he lives in Eau Claire, who's going around talking in many of our churches about the very subject you're talking about. He's written a book on it, and he is so refreshing. He's got his own practice, but then he goes out and talks to churches, and he was talking about his view of clothing. He has two suits. He said, I don't have to spend a lot of time choosing in the morning what suit I wear. And so he is reducing, in this one aspect, but in many others too. But it's very interesting. So there are a lot of people out there we've got to listen to and kind of look at this from our own point of view as to who we are and what we are and what we do have and how we use it.
Thanks.
A good example of how governments have come together would be the Antarctica situation, where certain rules have been set up as far as how that continent is to be used. And it's so pristine because of the governments allowing just a certain number of people there at a certain time, and all the rules that they have about taking care of that environment. And it's a number of nations that together have signed this agreement.
Claire, you want to say something?
For some people or some personalities, it's sometimes helpful to have a goal of where you want to be in terms of simpler living. And I imagine it's a pretty hard question of, you know, so I can do certain things that are simpler, but how far do I have to go? That's probably a hard question. Do you think that would be answerable at some point in the future? That's some quantifiable, you know, what do I have to do
to change it?
Wouldn't that be
to make a sustainable future?
Well, for a sustainable future for children, right? If, let's say that's our hope, right?
Right.
And for the other creatures, and that our world would be a healthy place to live for all creatures. Well, go ahead. Did you want to respond?
What I'm seeing is that when we become older, we start thinking differently. What I see is our children, and I'm speaking of children that are married, they got to have it all. And it seems like they got so much stuff they don't know where to put it. And now we got to have bigger homes, bigger garages. And so apparently we haven't communicated too well with our kids, and I'm as guilty as anybody here. I'm wondering how we can change it, how we can influence them enough to see that, well, I see it on the back of trucks every once in a while. The more toys I have or something like this, they're a winner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I think it's screwed up thought. And I think a lot of our youth have that same feeling that, you know, they need this, and then all of a sudden they have it for a little while and they realize it's not that great. Now it's something else they have to go to.
Well, it's an example of perhaps proving who you are by your possessions and positions of power. It's a need to self-justify.
Our society is based on it.
And, you know, to get back to that, Madison Avenue is brilliant. It will appeal to one of those efforts to self-justify. Prove who you are by your abilities. Come on now. Prove who you are by how people respond to you. Prove who you are by what you wear, your possessions and your status and so on. Madison Avenue knows that these are temptations of human, endemic to human nature, and has done a really good job of advertising in such a way that we buy into it, so to speak, over and over again. And Larry, your question is very difficult because, one, I never, and I don't think we would ever want to create this again, this sort of, this is what it will mean to live simply. Maybe it's better to, this is what it will mean to have a society that cares for all of life. And then I think we can paint some broad visions. We could say, for example, that cities would, I don't know, draw all their food from within 250 miles. Can you imagine if cities have agriculture vibrant enough and responsive enough locally to feed itself? Just think how many farmers could live close to a city, but also still have healthy rural communities. Just think of the decreased transportation that it would cost to get that food to the table. The average piece of food now travels 1,200 miles to get to your plate. What if we reduce that to within 250? Our global warming costs, or contributions to global warming, would go way down. So that would be one image, let's say an agriculture within 250 miles maybe. Another vision would be a tax structure that moved toward green taxes, so that we would not tax income maybe, and we would tax resource extraction. Another thing would be, the corporate charter. The corporate charter says corporations are individuals and have the rights of individuals. No, they're not individuals. They're a pile of money to which we give our allegiance, is what one commentator says about corporations. So we would want to revise the corporate charter so that, and maybe part of that would be those in charge would only be able to make so much more than those working in the factory, let's say. We have choices about how we structure our society. The corporate structure is not sort of a given from above. It's something we've created that governments support. We don't have to have that forever. As far as individual choices, if we want to bring it back to individual choices, the Union of Concerned Scientists has published this book called The Consumer's Guide to Effective Environmental Choices. And the Union of Concerned Scientists does really good work, at least I think so, and I'm very solid research and so on. And they have looked at, so the question, is plastic or paper, or, cloth diapers or disposable, or, and they just say, we tire ourselves out with questions that really aren't that important in the long run. So they're trying to help us think about what's most important as individual consumers in terms of our impacts. So individual consumers would want to think about three things. If you don't own a house, it's these three things. It's transportation is the number one way, is the number one choice we have in terms of changing it, in terms of our impact on the rest of the natural world. Transportation, how we get around. The second one is meat. Do we eat meat? How much do we eat? What kind of it? What kind is it? Where does it come from? How is it grown? The third one is fruits and vegetables and grains. So the top three, transportation, and the next two are food, in terms of our impacts as individuals on the natural world. And then for homeowners, the rest of them are around the care and upkeep of our homes and the impacts those homes have on the rest of the natural world. But Larry, hopefully our society would also need to shift to enable those individual choices to become easier as well. And in all cases, I think we need to create and encourage communities where this is talked about and cared about. And that's where I think the church can become very powerfully prophetic again. I mean, the church has been a powerful voice for social change before. Think of the abolitionist movement or women's suffrage or civil rights. At least parts of the church have been prophetically involved. And I think if our society is going to move toward this vision of greater sustainability, the churches have to be involved, because the churches are the one place in our society, hopefully anyway, and in some cases yes, where there's still some moral authority, where people look to the church and see that there's something there that's different. And one of the ways it's different, at least fundamentally, the churches do not demand that we look at the bottom line first. Whereas everything else, you have to look at the bottom line. And churches are a place where at least we say something beyond the bottom line matters. And there's moral authority in that position. And we have traditions in our scriptures that would back us up. So that's one of the reasons I get excited about working with churches, is that a fire might be lit, that we might move toward abundant life as understood in the kind of context we're talking about here, not the good life that our culture pushes on us, and that the churches need to realize they also push sometimes and support. So there's a call to change from within as well. I think it's about time for lunch.
But may I just make a comment about just, the
this woman? This woman had her hand up first, so let's. Okay. You haven't said anything yet, so.
I'm Jan Sicker from Portland, Oregon. I was just going to say, do you think there will ever be a day when this message is as loud as the message from Madison Avenue? Mm-hmm. And wouldn't that be wonderful? Our oldest daughter has worked for 3 different environmental organizations in Portland, one of which was the Sustainable Northwest, and I think Oregon is really out there, and probably Washington too, but doing some phenomenal things. And when she was working for this organization, it was wonderful how they awarded recognition to just small companies, larger companies, a rancher who, you know, that was doing sustainability within the Northwest, and it's very exciting to see. She comes into my house and checks my car. Mother, why are you using this kind of soap? Why are you?
My mom has her hand up. I have to call my mom.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I'd just like to make a comment. I mean, I feel that way too. Is our message ever going to be as loud as Madison Avenue? It's not unless we start doing
it. Right.
You know, I think we sort of are believers and know what's the way to go, but it's hard work, and it's, you know, get in your car and you drive and da-da-da. So I think we're it.
Yeah, and I'm excited to hear you say the church you think is a wonderful place to do this. We had somebody in our church this spring, we live in a suburb of Portland, said, let's have Martin's Garden every Sunday. Martin Luther's Garden, and everybody brought in their produce, and oh my gosh, it just turned out to be so successful and so exciting. Even the little kids, this is so neat, you know. And
it's a great story, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a huge percentage of the church that does not want this at all. You know, and pastors who start speaking, or churches that do, are just, things are made very tough for them.
Well, we're going to talk some tomorrow about global economics in the sacred universe, and how, in many ways, the nub of a lot of this is living in a universe that has been made profane by an economic system that forces everything to eventually be seen as a resource.
And a political system that's made it. I mean, we live in a secular world. Division of church and state and all this kind of stuff.
Let's have one more comment.
I was going to say, I've enjoyed the corn and fresh peaches here.
Yeah.
If I go back to Texas now, where we get these in June, do I lay a guilt trip on myself because I'm buying fruit and corn that's imported?
Yes, hopefully. No guilt. Guilt free. Last words from Paul. My brother-in-law has a comment. So.
It's better to do it tomorrow after you said what we'll be talking about tomorrow.
Okay, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Let's have a moment of prayer. And again, feel free to sign up on our mailing list if you'd like to find out more about Earth Ministry. Thanks, God, for this beautiful day again, and for the gift of this time together. May we go out rejoicing in this beautiful place where we are and this gift of this earth. In your name we pray, amen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.